Podcasts by Devils. Hello and welcome to the second Resilient Nation podcast. My name is Charlie Edwards. I'm the head of the security program at Demos and author of the forthcoming pamphlet, Resilient Nation. Today we are looking at social media and its relevance to disaster management and emergency planning. Today we'll be going beyond the hype to ask what social media is and how we might use it to build community resilience. I'm joined by David Stephen, Dominic Campbell and Justin Kerr Stevens.
So if we kick off with the first question, which is, what is social media?
So I guess social media is a collection of online tools that enable people to come together, to participate in the web, across the web, like they never have before, share their experiences, share their knowledge, actually post new content. Moving well beyond the sort of old form of web, which was very much broadcast and information provision.
If you're looking for a start date for social media, you're looking at the advent of certain tools. So you could look at Wikipedia, but wikis were in use before then. Yeah. Twitter's a recent phenomenon. Facebook recently celebrated their fifth birthday. So I think you could say elements of, the social web have been around for at least the last 10 years. But the web itself was originally designed or with the intent of being a more social model. So in some ways you could say we're catching up.
I mean, what can social media do that we couldn't do before?
Well, I certainly think social media, particularly in a government context, it reduces the transaction cost of information provision. So certainly in a strategic communications context, you can find that your online audience is a similar audience to those that you might have actually been trying to reach before. So actually pumping out information and using actually more of a broadcast model is quite easier. What you do find with, I guess, the social web and social media is that in pushing that information out, you're actually moving towards having a conversation with people. So the exchange of information and ideas becomes much richer. It doesn't become a central government broadcast piece, then it actually tries to become more of a dialogue about information and context more questions, in effect.
And as government is currently configured, is that something that comes easily to government, who normally, you know, who have previously always just been on a sort of broadcast message, as you said?
No, I mean, absolutely not. It's a massive challenge to the classic model. Controlled communications through a central press office with, you know, officers, civil servants who are very used to creating a single version of the brand around government and a single broadcast message. It's extremely complex for them to move from that situation to one where there may be multiple voices across a government department or across a council who are capable of talking on behalf of that organisation without permission or with permission, it doesn't really matter anymore, who are capable of distorting that brand image that you want to create. But in many ways, that's fantastic. You know, it's actually humanising government. You know, it's about how not only the government is responsible for government duties anymore, it's about how we're all responsible for the society that we live in. And, you know, the more that we can make that boundary between civic society and government more porous and human, the better chance we've got of actually resolving some of these issues that we face on a global scale.
I think there's a paradox there, though. We have this sense of we are the government, but we also have these enormous and unrealistic expectations of what government can do. If you just search for blame and government in the media every day, I mean, the government is expected to be responsible for just this vast array of our lives. So I think, you know, possibly what we're going to see happening in the next five or ten years is we get, you know, probably what will be a quite different politics out of the current, you know, economic meltdown and security difficulties, etc., is some new sense of where the individual is responsible, how communities work, and what we expect government to do.
I think the government also has, I mean, there's a tacit advantage in employing some of these strategies with citizens, being able to say that you have been able to co-produce a policy from the ground up and actually involve people puts you in a much, much stronger political position as well. And in doing that, you theoretically get better policy. So if you're looking to a target audience for a health-related issue, for example, working with those constituents that are impacted or affected by that health issue, and then you work to design the policy with them, it should be a tighter fit. It should be better policy.
Podcasts by Devils.
I'm interested in David's point about this tension between, on the one hand, you've got people who expect government to do more and more for them, but social media, as Dominic was saying, is actually making us more responsible at the same time for those decisions. So how does that tension manifest itself?
Well, I think it's difficult for all of the three major strands of political thought. You know, conservatives believe in the power of community to a certain extent or another, but they don't really they don't get this agenda. They don't really have a sense of the future and of change. Conservatism is often quite backward looking. Social Democrats, you know, they believe in public goods, but they there's a whole tradition going right back into the public health movements of the 19th century, gradually wrenching power out of communities and centralising and professionalising it. And then you've got the liberals, the libertarians, that streak of thinking that has been very powerful on the social web, where there is often, you know, a flowering of new thinking, but a deep hostility to what government can provide, particularly in the US libertarian movement. So you need to find a way of rebalancing and inventing a new politics out of that, at a time when government's not really functioning very well, and every government department is struggling to reinterpret its remit.
I think the really fascinating thing around all of that is that's true to an extent. But at the same time, that's very much coming at it from an established institutional perspective. And as people as Umir Haq are saying, you know, it's about what are the new forms of institution, what are the new rules in the economy and in politics as well. How are these new institutions being built outside of the traditional government's economy space? You know, a lot of this stuff is happening despite the government, outside of the government, away from the government. New politics is being formed, grassroots community organisations are mobilising. The government is becoming a one player in the field, essentially, rather than actually owning the field.
And I think that's even more true if you think internationally. You know, take a developing country, or take the cities in the developing world. They're likely to have 1.5 billion more people by 2030. At a time when allegedly we're going to do this massive global deal on climate, completely change the resources and emissions that they have available to them. Most of their populations live in informal, work in informal economies, live in slums and shanty towns, have very little contact with the formal political structure. So you have these cities, they're growing at this rapid rate, that are not really centrally governed in any meaningful way, and which will either go feral, or which will, as you say, invent a whole new way of working out in areas that people in the centre are barely aware exist.
I mean, there are some really interesting examples as well where the state is trying to blur its boundaries a little bit as well and experiment. So if you look at things like Social Innovation Camp, which was Nesta funded, so it's a grant-funded initiative from an arm's-length organisation, so it's very much at the periphery of core government, so it can experiment with these new ways of working. But within that, what they do is they put out a call for idea. They say, what's a social need that you recognise that the government is entirely missing? You know, it crowdsources hundreds of ideas, chooses some great ideas, and over the course of a weekend, you know, this wide array of techies and people who recognise the need come together and build whole new web-based institutions in a weekend almost, which can go forward and deliver what the government itself couldn't do and certainly couldn't construct in such a short space of time.
I think if you look at government and bureaucracy and the way it operates, its capacity to respond to certain situations or political issues is often quite slow. And what you do find, particularly with the social web, is the capacity for groups to become self-organising. And we've seen that in a number of examples, from the California wildfires to the recent snowstorms in the UK, Hurricane Katrina, the Australian bushfires recently is another good example. And they've all been used for slightly different things. So you might have had Twitter groups that were being used to try and find people to purely a fundraising effort, or to use groups just to network survivors together so that they actually feel like they're part of a community and part of something. And that's something that government, quite often with the best intentions, tries to do, but their response time can be so slow that the community already exists by the time they get around to actually trying to implement it.
In some ways, we're going back to old models, just with new tools. If you look at what happened in public health in the 19th century, citizens got together, they formed public health boards, and they just changed the way that cities were organised, and it had a radical effect. You look at TB, 1900 to 1950, the rate about halves, and that's before the antibiotics come in. That's so before any technology is applied. It was just done through the power of social organisation, and not so social organisation driven by the centre, social organisation coming up through citizens banding together. And that Victorian era was the great era of institutional innovation, and I see that we're in a period now where at global, national and local levels we need that flowering of social innovation to happen again if we're to solve this novel series of problems that we face.
Podcasts by Devils.
So to try and perhaps caricature what we've been discussing, social media is important because actually it plays to our individual strengths, and that is as social beings, that actually it's what we've always done, but we now have new tools to do it, and that actually what we're doing is wrestling power away from the government.
I'd actually suggest it plays to our collective strengths, not necessarily our individual strengths. The ability to be able to talk to people that share common ideals and that are equally talented in a number of areas, and you can then match skills very, very, very quickly with the ability to be agile and to respond, means that you're basically magnifying your level of impact on a certain situation. So as one person perhaps donating, you know, some money to a fund in a crisis, that might not have that much of an impact, but if you can get 150 people to do exactly the same thing at the same time, the response is magnified.
I mean, there'll be people who listen to this podcast who are assuming that, I think after something that Dominic said, that social media is led by geeks for geeks, but I seem to be getting the impression that actually this is a greater revolution, that there are millions of people using these things. Is that the case?
I think that would be fair. I mean, Facebook certainly, I wouldn't say it's ubiquitous, but it certainly has quite a high profile. It's talked about quite a lot in national media. If I could give one example, a few years ago there was a university student that graduated in London that found that HSBC had turned round and not given them the student banking deal that they'd actually agreed for. So he started up a "We don't like HSBC group" because they haven't fulfilled what we asked for on Facebook. A couple of members to begin with, word of mouth spread. It ended up getting into the thousands, and HSBC ended up reversing its decision. I think it does come down to your capacity to influence change, though, at a personal level, and it does, to a degree, have to do with your offline networks as well as your online networks. You do need to actually know a few people to start getting the ball rolling.
HSBC is a great example, but I mean, in many respects, it's an example of the kind of protest ethic that we have. I mean, is social media a force for good?
I mean, you're right. I mean, the activist side of things does get quite a lot of press, obviously, but there's, you know, a whole plethora of, you know, communities that are formed online that aren't about activism. They are about just peering. They're about sharing. They're about supporting one another. So, you know, the one that is often held up is Mumsnet. You know, that's where a bunch of mums have got together to share information, to support each other entirely outside of the state. It provides the government with a real opportunity to actually not get involved in something and just accept that it's not involved in that, and that those people are the experts in their own lives and in their own community, and that they should be the people who are supporting one another. You know, there is no need for the government to intervene in that. It's all about this rebalancing we were talking about earlier, about where the government has a role and where it no longer needs to have a role. And social media is certainly one of the driving forces behind that, because of the scale of social media, you know, the communities that you can bring together en masse, instantly, almost.
I mean, if you could sum up why social media or rather why government should be interested in social media, what would your reasons be?
For me, it would be about leverage, right, above anything else. You know, it's about influence at a far greater scale than it has previously. It's about how can it try and pull levers to enact behaviour change in a population, whereas previously, you know, it would be broadcasting simple messages in a very blunt fashion.
I mean, it will happen without government, I think, is the simplest reason. People will aggregate a common purpose and work towards their ambitions, and government has an opportunity at this point to actually be involved in that and to actually develop policy around those groups that are forming and listen to them and get their feedback. So it's not necessarily a case of the top-down model where someone in Whitehall will sit there and develop policy and say, this is the right thing for this community. It's much more about being involved in what a community is saying they want for them.
Podcasts by Demos.
I mean, presumably government, the British government, that is using social media. I mean, has it taken off like wildfire, or are there still issues with it?
It's very difficult being in this space and speaking about it, because you feel like it has taken off massively, because you are so aware of the people who are pushing it, the people like Tom Watson in the Cabinet Office, who's been a fantastic advocate. But the reality is it hasn't taken off like wildfire. There are some really, really great examples that we can build on. You know, the Power of Information Review, for instance, is doing great things and has had publicity globally, not just within Britain. But again, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, there is this tension where I think government still remains in the geek social media space to a degree, and it's trying to go down quite technical implementation in a way of social media, whether it's from a comms or from an IT perspective. Both of those are almost coming at it from rule books and, you know, the how-to guide to do this stuff, and that's just not the way to do it. They've really got to empower and give permission for the civil service to go out and play with this stuff and to get involved in it. But unfortunately, at the moment, even with the new civil service code of conduct or the guidelines around social media, I don't think it goes far enough to actually say to people this stuff's okay. Because, you know, there've been examples where civil servants have been punished for writing blogs. It just takes one of those to really set the movement back, unfortunately.
I think there are two key problems for government, two different problems. One is that social media is about the death of the permission society. You don't have to ask, you can just do. And that was the first blog I was involved in setting up. I mean, that's just so wonderful. In an afternoon, there it was, up and running. We hadn't asked for funding, we hadn't asked anybody to do it. It just was there, and we were committed to it. And then I think the second related point that comes out of that is that it's about content, and governments are frightened of being interesting. You thrive in social media spaces if you have something to say, because you haven't asked for permission. You are just there, and now you've got to build your own audiences. And to give you an example, when, you know, recently there was a lot of trouble in northern Nigeria, the media reporting was quite poor. I was really struggling to work out what was going on, and I got in touch with the Foreign Office through its Twitter feed and said, you know, your High Commissioner in Nigeria currently has a blog, but we haven't heard anything from him about what's going on. Can you email him and ask him to give us a heads up on what's happening out there? And, you know, he did blog about 3 weeks later, and I think it was, by memory, I think it was about visas. So he'd missed this huge issue in his country where potentially people would have flooded onto the site to read his content.
There has to be an acknowledgement that there's a practical consideration into what might happen if a high commissioner to a country was to actually blog about something that could be potentially perceived as politically contentious. And that's one of the issues I think you find continually with government, is moving them from a position where they're completely risk averse to one in which they're more or less risk aware and more willing to actually try and see things. I think certainly in the central government context, there are some really interesting examples of the deployment of social media at a departmental level, but less so when you think about it from a cross-government approach or a coordinated approach across perhaps even local government. So I think one of the things you find is that you might have somebody that's very, very good and very adept at using these tools and manages to tick the boxes and get it through a number of departmental hoops and barriers, and then finally gets it through and they find that they're not part of an integrated campaign to draw attention or awareness to what's happening. And a tool standing by itself will get some level of engagement, but you'll often find that what you still need to actually rely on is a level of broadcast media support to draw people to that tool and raise awareness and attention.
You mentioned, just moving away from central government for a moment, that local government is also involved in this.
So, I mean, for me, local government makes a lot of sense, you know, in terms of the right level of communication with people using social media. They're all about communities, you know, they've got their natural constituency of community already. They're there trying to bring together people on and offline to support the councils, but support themselves to actually improve local communities, to actually come together and support each other to actually deliver change in the local area. So it could be, you know, parent teachers association, a way of expanding that out to just people who are capable of turning up at meetings. An example of Barnet Council, where I'm working at the moment, the leader of the council there does this thing called Leader Listens, and he goes to a new council ward every month, essentially holds a community meeting, gets maybe 50 people there, which is pretty good for that kind of event, but it's still 6 o'clock on a Tuesday evening in damp North London, and so what he's now doing is actually publishing video of him speaking at that event on his blog immediately afterwards with the minutes and actions that came out of that meeting, to give people the opportunity to actually comment on what their neighbours and what the leader of their council have been talking about behind their back.
I mean, we've done all the rah-rah and isn't this great stuff. I mean, I think there is a paradox here, in that it's, if you think about the power of these tools and you think about the complex systems that we work in, it's actually much, much easier to think about ways of using those tools to break our systems than it is to think about ways to enhance them. And I think this is one of the reasons why established organisations, including governments, have to get involved in this stuff, because I'm not totally convinced that if it is just left to the grassroots, we're going to get some nice outcomes. I think we could really see, particularly, you know, in Europe, but also particularly in developing countries, we could see some forces that will embrace these tools for really quite counterproductive ends. I mean, you know, John Robb and his idea of global guerrillas, people who are finding that they're multi-connected. That their multi-connections and that hyper-empowerment allows them to take on nation-states in a way that would have been impossible a couple of months ago.
I mean, and I think, I mean, there was some, certainly online there was coverage of the Mumbai bombings and people using Twitter to actually coordinate activities, and also offline technologies like SMS and mobile phones. But to start seeing something that is probably slightly more in a geeky sense that people use, but to start seeing it actually being used in something like that, it does start to become a bit more concerning and a bit scarier.
For those people who don't know about it, even though I think it's now, you know, a top news story in most newspapers, given that people like Jonathan Ross and Stephen Fry use it. I mean, what is Twitter for the uninitiated?
Lets you update what you're doing in 140 characters or less. So you could think of it as the equivalent of an SMS on your mobile phone, but you're doing it online and you're able to communicate to a much wider community of people that are following you or that you're following.
And why would people want to know what I'm doing in 140 characters? Because surely that can't be very much information.
It's interesting you say that, because there was a few people the other day actually talking about trying to get rid of that little slug line off the top of the website. I think that was probably what they started with, and it's evolved a bit from there. So people quite often now use it to disseminate information. So they might be saying, I've just blogged about this and here's the link. Or people might actually turn around and say, I've just read this and this is a really good article, you should go here and look at this. And then there's also the real-time capacity that it has. So it's been quite evident in things like hurricane disasters, fires, those types of things.
So there's something magical about short communications. I don't really understand what it is, but look at what happens to text messaging. This little bit of a mobile phone protocol that I don't really understand that seems to have got in there by accident. And the first generation of users, it was all voice, and then it suddenly went down to a new generation, and pretty much all they were using was text messages, and you began to see these informational networks growing across generations. Twitter just takes that idea and extends it, and because it's more visible, because you can see what many people are doing, when something big happens, it tends to jump up into another level, and you get messages being, you know, rippling out virally across a network of people. It has a consciousness under that kind of pressure and stress.
I think there's also, there's less of an overload. If you look at the way people currently have to deal with email, if an email's sitting in your inbox and it's not read, you've got something that tells you day in, day out, this many unread messages. Whereas Twitter, whilst it's always great to respond to people that have been talking to you, the pace of conversation moves quite quickly. So if you're not there and you're not sitting there and listening to things, it's not as bad because you can rejoin that conversation later.
It's like a river flowing past and you just dip your hand in every so often.
And the beauty for organisations, I guess, is, as with all these other tools, not just to focus on Twitter, is the power of breaking down silo mentality. It has the ability to cross-cut policy themes or departments or whatever. It brings people together in a new and powerful way that, you could have been previously, knowing Whitehall, you could have previously been sat in an office next door to somebody who was fascinating to you and your work and not having spoken to them in 10 years. Twitter and other things like that, you were in contact with your equivalent in Barcelona in an instant because somebody recommended them onto you. I kind of view it as my ideal office in some ways, because I've chosen to follow these people because they're interesting and they're relevant to my work and to my life.
Okay, so I can understand why you, Dominic, are on Twitter, but surely government departments aren't on Twitter either. Surely that's a step too far.
Well, you've got Downing Street, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. There's a range of them. There's feeds that have been aggregated together for the Department of Health. There's an aggregated feed that captures all news releases across government. And then there's a number of civil servants that are there as well that are known to the wider community, and they're up front. You know exactly who you're talking to and engaging with.
So why is number 10 on Twitter? Surely that is a waste of time for most people concerned.
It's quite an interesting one, actually, because I don't think it's quite matured yet totally as a model. There's been a bit of a kerfuffle, for instance, that Boris Johnson is on Twitter and he has 2,000-3,000 followers and has taken the decision not to follow anybody back. And there's almost this Twitter etiquette where you're meant to follow people back. But when you're Stephen Fry, who's on 170,000 followers, they use the same argument for Boris Johnson. He's obviously on it just to broadcast messages. He's not listening because he's not following anyone. Well, one, that just proves they don't understand the technology, because you don't have to follow people to be able to read the responses to your tweets. And two, you just have to face the facts that we're not at a point yet where anyone, I believe, has developed a sophisticated enough listening tool to actually aggregate this data and to make it useful to government or to major organisations, where you have this mass of voices coming back at you, and then it's driving frustration from some people in certain quarters because they feel that they've got some God-given right to be listened to and something to be changed as a result of what they've said in 140 characters, and it's ludicrous. So I think there needs to be a bit of a balancing out on both sides, really. Realistic expectations, but also support to organisations and government to help make sense of this information far more effectively.
Traditional organisations are quite inward-looking. They find it quite difficult to understand the world outside them. And I think the Foreign and Commonwealth Office person behind that feed, I would hope, probably gets more from the people that he or she follows than they do from the amount of information they project out. As, you know, they're working on the G20, the London summit at the moment. I'm sure they're constantly looking for other people in organisations who have something to say on that summit, or who are working on that on that summit, so that they can begin to bring it together into something coherent as we reach the date in April when Obama will be here and the attention of the world will be on London for him.
So why should a civil servant, a public servant in government or indeed local government, use social media? I mean, there seem to be a raft of examples of where social media is either a force for good or indeed a force for bad. Mm-hmm. But why should they, you know, get on the bandwagon?
I mean, one key example that we use in Barnet Council is we use Google Alerts, which is the simplest of listening devices, essentially, where you put in keywords like Barnet Council, like, you know, rubbish collection in Barnet, like whatever, so that you can actually be alerted instantly by Google, or near instantly, every time something new is mentioned on the web. And we had this one case of an alert coming through from a new blog that had been set up called I Pay Barnet Council Tax for This, and Barnet Council is Rubbish was the subtitle. And obviously that came through quite strong on Google Alerts. So we contacted them back. We commented back on their blog. They had very good evidence as to the issue they were facing in terms of rubbish in their streets. There was photographs, there was over time, there was description. They had been ignored by customer services because it is, you know, customer services is another control mechanism like communications. It is very much one-on-one relationship. You send an email, it disappears into a black hole, nobody else knows you've sent it, they can ignore you. Unfortunately, in this case, they had fallen through that gap. They blogged out of frustration. We were astonished that we were listening and found it. We found out that we didn't really have jurisdiction over the area because it was private property, but instead of doing the classic hand-washing approach, we actually went down there, brought together the landlord, the shop owners, the residents, and now we're working with them with a very small pot of cash that the council has provided to actually improve that area. You know, that's just a really small example of something that can be quite impactful if the council is willing to listen.
I think there are also times when, you know, civil servants get stuck. You're working on a piece of policy or a project or information, and you've exhausted a range of options to try and track something down or find additional information. And it's at that point that you could turn to social media and actually ask for help. Unfortunately, the associated risk in doing that is that you can also reveal how little government might know about something, which is again one of the common problems that you face.
Podcasts by Devils.
We've seen the impact social media has on society, but I'm interested to know whether people feel that social media has had an impact in the resilience space.
There's an old-fashioned view that resilience is just about bouncing back at a time of crisis, but I think a more powerful definition of resilience is to see it as the process a society has to go through to maintain its integrity and its functioning through all the changes that it's undergoing. And we're currently living at a time of massive stress and change, and we're clearly going to be in a very different place in 5 or 6 years time than we are now. A resilient community is a community that has the connections to be able to cope with those stresses, whether they are long-term stresses or the kind of short-term shock that we think of as being an emergency. I think what social media contributes is it contributes the connections that people rely on. It builds the networks that make societies more resilient.
But I mean, Justin, you talked about the fact that social media is being used with the bushfires in Australia at the moment, with the UK snowstorm that we had recently, the Mumbai bombings, and various other places. I mean, what role does social media play in that resilience space?
I think it enables a coordination and an aggregation of ideas and news, in effect. So it acts very much as an early warning system. certainly in the Californian context, you had people that were actually tracking where fires were approaching and actually turning around and saying, it's on this ridge, I can see it from my house. And you actually had examples where I think the California Fire Brigade was then turning around and monitoring that, would confirm it, and then would relay that and stick it on its central website. So the fire department, in effect, was able to aggregate information. They had a range, hundreds of free spotters on the ground that were turning around and saying there's a wildfire here, and they were very, very quickly able to understand and establish where the fire was. Perhaps a more altruistic example in the recent Australian bushfires was that the Country Fire Association website became overloaded. There were so many people visiting it that it kept crashing. Google very quickly pulled together information from a variety of sources and built a mashup on a map and then started publicising it to take some of the strain off the CFA website. So you've got examples of big international companies that are turning around and saying, right, well, what can we do and how can we help in this context?
Just explain for those people who don't know what a mashup is.
A mashup is a way of bringing in information from all sorts of different sources and putting it together in a way that, you know, that people can understand and read.
So what's it like?
Well, it would be a website, but it's a website that maybe pulls in some information from Twitter, some information from blogs, and puts it into maybe places it on a Google map so you can see where different things are happening. But I think what's important about it is it's a filter. It's somebody doing some of the work for you of trying to work out what is important, what in this stream of knowledge you should be paying attention to. And I think it's particularly powerful when that's done just outside government. I think there's this very interesting grey space outside government where you can be trusted by people within the government system, but you can also have roots and contacts in the community, because there's often quite a lot of anger with government organisations during disasters, because very often, for one reason or another, they are failing to discharge what citizens want them to do. So people who can sit in that middle space and be trusted and provide a new level of information and have an authenticity about them, I think are in a very powerful position.
The wider the network, the more resilient networks are, obviously, and these tools are enabling those wide networks. Lee Bryant, actually, at Headshift, has this phrase around organisational immune systems, but it could be applied to social immune systems, and how, you know, bringing social networks together in quite loose ways actually enhances that immune system, so that you've got people who are able to sort of support each other outside of the state. It's no longer this one-to-one dependency relationship with government. You actually have this social immune system where people are capable of supporting one another and reacting in crisis, whether it's through taking government data with some other data and bringing it together and presenting it in a new and interesting and helpful way, or whether it's finding other people who can literally come and help you and come and support you in moments of crisis or everyday situations to enhance resilience in that way as well.
I think, there's a number of examples of private companies that are actually starting to use the power of networked citizens to actually help them. So, CNN now has a weekly feature called iReport. They rely on citizen journalists that are out there with their mobile phones, taking video, taking shots. When there's a crisis or a situation, not only do they pick up on people's Twitter feeds, but you can submit photos from the website. And they basically provide the one spot, the mashup, the place to aggregate all that information. And then CNN rebroadcasts it. So they're getting essentially free material and free information, particularly in crisis spots. I mean, you can't have a journalist everywhere at once at the same time.
So what I'm hearing is that social media is effective because it creates better shared awareness.
Yeah, I think it does. I think you can't really expect resilience just to be there when you need it. It has to be a pre-existing stock in whatever community you're looking at. And I, at its worst, governments have stripped resilience away from communities. I think, again, if you go back to the health example, If we have an avian flu, a major avian flu outbreak, that the 95% of the caring will be done in the community, but most of the planning will have been done by professionals in government. So the planning is being done by people who will not be the people who are dealing with much of the problem. I think if you invest out in resilience, if communities have built these connections, these networks and these structures before the big disaster hits, then they are in much better shape to make things happen. Yes, they have shared awareness, they have a similar way of thinking and talking about the idea, they have a common language, but they've also built platforms on which you can build activity very, very quickly when you need to if disaster strikes.
Podcasts by Devils.
Dominic, you said you were talking about everyday resilience, and we'll come back to disasters in a moment because I think there are some great examples. But I mean, what did you mean by everyday resilience?
I mean, I guess it's very much related to that last point around building in existing support structures, so recreating that social capital that has been stripped away in loads of cases, in various policy areas or various communities. It's about putting people back in touch with each other and revealing yourself to other people again so that you can make those very human connections, so that in moments of crisis you are capable or comfortable with connecting with people and supporting other people who you may have looked at suspiciously or unnerved by previously. I mean, an example might be, for instance, when in a local government context, where there's a bunch of individuals who are receiving direct payments from the council, and they are having to go out now with their own personal budget and buy their own care, essentially. And that may be that they don't want to go to a day centre anymore, and they may be able to buy a season ticket for a football club instead, because that gives them better mental well-being. This is a great policy initiative, but without the support network, their personal ability to cope in that more devolved way as an individual who is now much more responsible for their own care, it does put them at risk. And there are opportunities through social media to enable peer-to-peer support and sharing, increased resilience in that way, whereby you could have, say, 600 personal budget users in one area who share a common Google group or Facebook group or whatever, and are able to communicate with each other regularly and to support each other around issues such as, my personal assistant's going on holiday next week. Can anyone else share theirs with me for a bit? Because otherwise I'm going to be left high and dry and I can't get anyone in from the agency.
I mean, this all sounds fantastically expensive. I mean, is it?
No. It's free, essentially. I mean, a Google group's free. You could go big if you wanted, and going big would probably mean £100,000, which in government IT terms is probably,
a drop in the ocean.
Exactly. Yeah.
Bring it closer to home. As society, how can the government use social media, to become more resilient? It's something that Dominic was saying.
I don't think it's necessarily about how can the government use social media. I think it's about having a greater level of awareness about what social media is being used for already, looking at community groups and support groups, certainly at a local level, and understanding how they work and how they're used, and listening to what they have to say before actually engaging with them. Certainly on a national level, where I guess you're facing an emergency, the time frames are far more pressing, but you can quickly find where there might be areas of information and people that are sitting there and they're saying things and putting it out, and people are listening to that. So it would be engaging with them. It almost involves a press officer starting to realise that their audience isn't just a number of journalists. It might actually be a number of journalists plus two key bloggers in this area, and engaging with them to send out reassuring messages.
But what about the so-called digital divide, those people who don't have the internet, who aren't online? How do we go about bringing them and engaging with them?
And one of the areas that I think is crucial and completely underexploited at the moment is text messaging and SMS. It's an area where, that digital notion of digital divide doesn't really exist when you're talking about mobile phones and texts. And it's something that we've unilaterally failed to exploit. If I was going to recommend one tool
I mean, what can it do that when we're not doing it at the moment?
Well, it's astonishing that we still don't have a mass alert system, for instance. You know, there was a point where I was considering using Twitter when it provided free text messages as a way of mass communicating with the population. I mean, there's, whatever it is, 2 mobile phones per person on average in this country now. You know, it's ridiculous. You would reach everybody, or 99% of everybody. Yes, we don't have a way of exploiting that technology. And the technology itself isn't resilient, as we saw during the London bombings. It fell over in an instant, and there just hasn't been that focus that there could be in that area.
I think, I mean, just on the technology falling over, I think that's another interesting point. A lot of this comes down to infrastructure and the redundancy of that infrastructure. And in a crisis, it's actually understanding how resilient is your network and how quickly can you actually get out a message and communicate to people. So, you know, you might be using your laptop to Twitter about something in a fire situation, but the moment the power goes down and the fire gets slightly closer, I can imagine that sending out a 140 character update is the last thing on your mind.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that's a really good example of where governments can stick to the things they really are responsible for. You know, our infrastructure in this country is not resilient at all. There's very little spare capacity. So just when people are trying to communicate with each other, it's almost certain that, you know, the infrastructure will fall over. That's a problem that government departments can fix.
I think we're seeing a number of things. We're seeing, in essence, a resilient society in the sense that there are self-organising groups of people that are coming together and often using social media tools. And what we're trying to do is see if government actually has a place in listening, monitoring and being a part of that interaction, in complementing what they normally do, which is managing the infrastructure, those types of things.